This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. After a two-week-long struggle against an as-yet unidentified ailment, Yasser Arafat died last night in a hospital outside of Paris. Arafat was the principal architect of the Palestinian movement. He helped create and led Fatah, the largest and most important group in the PLO, the Palestine Liberation Organization, which he also headed. Later, there was no one to compete for the leadership of the Palestinian Authority when that was created. That three different men have today been named to assume leadership of those three positions at Fatah, the PLO, and the Palestinian Authority suggests the size of the political vacuum that follows his death. We'll begin this hour with a look back at the life of Yasser Arafat. If you have questions about how he came to power, how he used it, and how we should remember him, our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. Later in the program, we'll get reaction from Jerusalem, ask how a new Palestinian leadership may emerge, and we'll talk about the U.S. role in the post-Arafat Middle East. But first, joining us here in Studio 3A is Lauren Jenkins, NPR's Senior Foreign Editor. Lauren, and very nice of you to be with us today.
Thank you, Neil. Good to be here.
You had the chance to interview Arafat many times over your career. What was the first time you met him?
I think the first time I met him was in Jordan in 1970. I was a young reporter then with Newsweek, and it was when Black September had blown up, multiple hijackings of planes. Arafat then was... The PLO was then very much in control or contesting even the city of the capital city of Jordan, Amman. They were all over the place and were battling King Hussein's troops at the time. I was taken to, as usual happened when you tried to interview him, you were sort of waited in your hotel till midnight. Someone came, knocked on a door. You were driven around blindfolded, and you ended up in a building, and there was Arafat.
When you try to interview people, obviously, reporters have their agenda. Political leaders tend to have theirs. Was he a man who was easy to get to answer your questions, or was he insistent on giving his answers?
He was insistent on giving his answers. He was a terrible interview from a Western journalist's point of view. You could go and ask him all the hard questions you wanted to, and he basically responded with rhetoric, very cryptic hints maybe at positions he might take, but never very clear. He loved obfuscation, I think, when dealing with the West. He loved to keep his cards very close to his chest and not tip them up. Show him until he was ready.
That gives you some insight into the experiences of those who negotiated with him.
Absolutely, absolutely. Yeah. He was never a man to open up very much, and he embodied himself. He saw himself as the embodiment of the Palestinian people and the only person who could carry through the dreams of Palestinian self-determination.
He never did designate a successor, but this was a conscious decision.
Oh, absolutely. Although throughout his career, he's always been surrounded by very loyal acolytes. Some deputies, some of the best, were killed in battle, assassinated by the Israelis in various cases in Tunis, like Abu Jihad was in the 80s, and Abu Iyad also in the 80s was killed in Portugal. These were people who, have had they lived today, might have been the logical successors, but... they were killed.
He also had his battles within the Palestinian movement as well. There were other groups that emerged to rival either Fatah or the PLO, who we don't hear so much of these days.
Oh, absolutely. I think that, you know, what often is not understood about the PLO, everyone thought of it as one organization, but in fact it was an umbrella of at some point nine organizations. At one point, I think it was 13. And they all fought within the PLO for their own policies, their own ideologies, and he was sort of the chief among other mediators, but he didn't always totally control the PLO.
As chairman of the PLO, as the head of Fatah, and later as the Palestinian, the head of the Palestinian Authority, which of those positions was the most important?
Oh, it's hard to say. I think they all, to him, were the same. They were all leadership of the Palestinian movement in various guises. Fatah was important because it was his organization, the PLO, because it embodied all the organizations that were fighting for the same thing. And finally, I think president of the Palestine Authority was the closest he could see to coming to being president of an independent Palestinian state.
Some of his actions throughout his career can be described as ruthless. He was willing to spill blood if that's what it took. Did he ever speak to you in the times that you met him about having any remorse over some of the actions that he took?
Not really. I don't think so. I think they were all seen as tactics of a movement, a revolutionary movement, in a certain period of time. He thought violence was necessary. I think he later moved beyond it after everything leading up to Oslo and after the Oslo Accords. He started to see himself as a statesman. Although certainly people around him still used violence, he tolerated it. Some would say he actually still orchestrated it, although that's not really very clear.
Much about his career isn't clear, and again, perhaps not a coincidence.
Absolutely.
We're taking calls if you'd like to join us. Our number is 800-989-8255. We're remembering Yasser Arafat. Email to TOTN@npr.org. Our guest is NPR senior foreign editor Lauren Jenkins, who met Yasser Arafat and interviewed him many times. And let's get a caller on the line. Melissa is with us from Grand Rapids in Michigan.
Yes, hi there.
Hi.
My question is this. As Yasser Arafat was leader in Palestine, I'm wondering how his leadership may have changed over the years, wondering if he began as somebody who was more revolutionary and interested in and connected to the needs of the people there. And as time went on, was his leadership something that became more disconnected to the folks there in Palestine?
I don't think his leadership changed much at all. I think he was an autocrat from start to finish. As I said, he always believed only he had the keys to the dream of Palestinian self-determination. And as such, he was very much dictatorial in his immediate circle. He was the leader. He wasn't corrupt, but he tolerated corruption. The people around him, I think the greatest sin of his leadership was that he allowed the people around him to be corrupt, and he allowed the people around him to lose sight of what their broader mission was.
How would you relate his leadership style to that of maybe a Fidel Castro or a Che Guevara? And I will take the rest of the answer off the air.
Thanks for the call, Melissa.
Thank you.
Probably more ruthless than Fidel Castro or Che Guevara.
Explain.
Well, I think he was more willing to use, certainly in his early days, violence, terrorism, hijacking planes, assassinations, attacks against the Israeli forces occupying, what he considered the territories of Palestine.
Early on, when he was challenged, particularly the PLO and the Palestinian Authority were really challenged by Hamas in recent years, the emergence of suicide bombers, and he chose to emulate that tactic as a tactic really of attack against the Israelis, or was it a tactic of battling his own opposition, Hamas?
Well, it's never clear that he chose to emulate Hamas at all. He was having an internal political battle with Hamas, which was much more extreme and much more unwilling to deal with the Israelis at all. I mean, Hamas opposed the Oslo Accords that Yasser Arafat
agreed to.
There were elements within his Fatah movement that spun off because they thought his movement had become too moderate, who then took up and rivaled Hamas in terms of suicide bombings. But
yeah,
it was never totally clear or established that these were direct orders from Arafat rather than spin-off people that he no longer could control.
An email question from Becky Fessenden in South Bend, Indiana. I understand Yasser Arafat was worth $1 billion. How did he obtain his wealth?
Well, the wealth of Arafat, one of the great mysteries that maybe has died with him. He obtained wealth. He always, to run a movement, he got donations. There were shakedowns. There were contributions from Palestinians around the world, various Arab regimes, Saudi Arabia, among many, contributed money to the PLO to keep it operating over the decades. He, like he ran everything, controlled the money too, and it's no one knows how much money was banked and how much went into the PLO itself, how much he may have put in private banks as a slush fund to keep the movement alive. As I said, no one really thinks he was corrupt because he never used money for himself, but he used it for his mission and what he sought for the organization.
Obviously, he achieved a great deal. There is something of substance that he has left behind. He made mistakes, though, along the way, tactical mistakes and even strategic mistakes. And some would say his embrace of Saddam Hussein before the first Gulf War represented a defeat for the Palestinians afterwards, and even perhaps the Second Intifada.
Absolutely. You know, a lot of critics, and I think I would enjoy among them, would say, you know, he never missed an opportunity to shoot himself in the foot. He made a lot of mistakes. He kept his vision alive of Palestinian nationalism, but at the same time, he lost a lot of opportunities. He was very slow to react to new situations, and he often came around to accept something 10 years too late when it was no longer on the table.
Let's get another caller on the line. Roland is with us from Tucson, Arizona.
Yes, my question is, should we be mourning the death of Arafat, or should we be celebrating his death?
Well, that's a big question. Depends what you want to see in the future. I think for all of his faults, Arafat held together, was the only leader the Palestinian people could see themselves following. He was considered really to embody, he was the George Washington of Palestinian nationalism. With his death, I think you're going to see a battle for power. I don't think transition is going to be very smooth. I think there are a lot of rival factions, and it could be that it'll be a nightmare because there'll be no one to give any guidance at all to the Palestinian movement, which might leave it to the extremists to carry out their own violent ends.
And thank you very much for the call, Roland. And I was going to ask you about the strengths of the organizations. As an administrator, as the head of the Palestinian Authority, was certainly not Yasser Arafat's shining moment in terms of his career. Has he left structures behind that will withstand the power struggles that may emerge?
Well, that remains to be seen. I think some structures were built up when the Palestine Authority was created. The problem is the Palestine Authority has been under siege for 3 years now from Israeli authorities. The police have been decimated. A lot of the institutions that were built up have collapsed. There's not much there. And Arafat was the only thing holding anything together, a lot of people think, and I think it's going to be very difficult to see a really viable state emerge, even if it's offered.
Mm-hmm. And briefly, we're going to be taking up this question as we continue later in the program, but briefly, how does, given the credentials of a Yasser Arafat to lead this movement, how does a successor gain that kind of legitimacy?
It's going to be very hard. It's hard to imagine anyone having that sort of legitimacy. I mean, this was a man who spent his whole life serving the cause. He was a symbol around the world of what the Palestinians stood for. His successors or the people battling for him are mostly pretty much unknown to the outside world, and a lot of them aren't very well known to the Palestinians themselves. It's going to be very hard for anyone to emerge with his sort of credibility and clout.
Whatever's happened today is certainly a corner has been turned. Lauren Jenkins, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you, Neil.
Lauren Jenkins is NPR's senior foreign editor. He was kind enough to join us here in Studio 3A. We're talking, of course, about Yasser Arafat, his life, and what happens next. When we come back from a short break, we'll get an update from Jerusalem and continue to pursue the question of how the Palestinians choose a successor to Yasser Arafat and what sort of legitimacy that person may have. If you'd like to join the conversation, our number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. You can also send us email, totn@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. Back after the break, it's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking about the death of Yasser Arafat, reaction to it, and how this will affect the Palestinian quest for a nation state. Joining us now is Daoud Kitab, a columnist for the Jordan Times and Jerusalem Post, also director of the Institute for Modern Media at Al-Quds University in Jerusalem. And it's very good of you to join us today.
Thank you very much, Neil.
Can you describe the scene in Jerusalem now or today? What's gone on?
Well, actually, I'm in Ramallah today. For a while, it was a bit quiet, but in the evening, there was all kinds of demonstrations, people carrying black flags and pictures of Arafat roaming around the city, and it filled the whole area around the Mukata, the last place where Arafat was holed up in and where he will be buried tomorrow. It's a mixture of a relief as well as sadness. People have been in a state of flaw for the last 2 weeks, not knowing whether their leader is going to live or die. There is some sadness, but I feel there is more of a relief that this ordeal is over because people lost lots of sleep over the last few days.
What's been a reaction from prominent Palestinians, and what have the Israelis been saying?
Well, the Israelis have, I think, been trying to be quiet. They have been saying the right things about wanting to get back the negotiations and so on. But I don't think they've said much, and I think that's better that way.
And Palestinians, I'm sure, are speaking, in honor of their leader who has been for so long the embodiment of their national struggle.
He has been, and he's the only one that most Palestinians living today know. He was in power for more than 40 years. For Palestinians in the occupied territories, the majority of the population is under 30, so you can imagine that most people living today only know him as the leader. So it will take time before that it sinks in that the leader with the keffiyeh on and the man who the whole world knew as the Mr. Palestine is no longer there.
What sorts of preparations are being made? As you mentioned, there's to be a funeral first in Cairo, and then the coffin will be flown onto Ramallah and the former headquarters.
Yes, they've been frantic in the last 2 days in the Mukata, cleaning up lots of the rubbles and clearing out the areas for the helicopters, as well as the location where the memorial where Arafat will be laid to rest. Political level, of course, has been also active. They had meetings yesterday and today, official meetings as well as unofficial meetings. Arafat was replaced by three different people, if you will. Mahmoud Abbas was elected as the chairman of the Executive Committee of the PLO. This is the highest, most important organization in Palestine. Ahmed Qarah continues to be the prime minister, but Rawhi Fattouh, the Speaker of the Parliament, was sworn in replacing Arafat as the head of the Palestinian National Authority. And Farouk Qaddoumi, Arafat's co-founder of Fatah, the movement of the PLO, the Arafat's movement, was elected by the Central Committee of Fatah as replacing Arafat in that position. So anyway, three different people have taken Arafat's many positions.
And again, the funeral will be held tomorrow. Daoud Kitab, thank you very much for being with us today.
You're welcome.
Daoud Kitab joined us by phone from Jerusalem. He's a columnist for the Jordan Times and the Jerusalem Post, also director of the Institute of Modern Media at Al-Quds University in Jerusalem. Joining us by phone now from his office at Columbia University in New York is Rashid Khalidi. Professor Khalidi is the author of Resurrecting Empire, Western Footprints and America's Perilous Path in the Middle East, the Edward Said Chair of Arab Studies at Columbia. Good to have you back on Talk of the Nation. Hello, Rashid Khalidi. We thought we had Professor Khalidi on the phone with us, and he is not there yet. We'll try to reestablish contact and get back in touch with him momentarily. And let's see if we can get We'll look at some of the dates in Yasser Arafat's life as we try to get Professor Khalidi back on the phone. He was born August 4th, 1929, in Cairo, Egypt, the fifth child of Palestinian merchant Abdel Rauf al-Qudwa al-Husseini. He formed the Palestinian Students League in 1949. In 1965, he established the Fatah guerrilla movement, which became the core group of the Palestine Liberation Organization. It mounted its first attack on Israel just 2 days later, March 21st, 1968, the Israeli army attacked a PLO base in Jordan, which provoked thousands to join the PLO. And in February of 1969, he took over chairmanship of the PLO. I think we have Professor Rashid Khalidi with us now on the phone from New York. Are you there, sir?
Yes, I am.
I apologize for that earlier mistake. What happens now? We were hearing from Daoud Khatoub in Jerusalem of the three people have been named to take over the three important positions that Yasser Arafat held. He named the people who have been taking over those positions, yet to most Americans and perhaps to people around the world, these are relatively unknown.
They are unknown. There are actually four, one of them almost completely unknown. The person who's been named to take over the PLO Executive Committee, the new chair, is Abu Mazen, Mahmoud Abbas.
Mm-hmm. Former Prime Minister.
He is a former Prime Minister. He is a long-standing member of the Fatah Central Committee, not one of the founders of Fatah, but one of the older members of that Central Committee. He's someone who hasn't got a lot of personal popularity, was never associated with armed struggle, never involved in military activity, one of the architects of the Oslo Accords, and someone who has not got any kind of really profound support among Palestinians. Another is Abu Ala, the current prime minister. He stays in that job. Another person who is part of the old guard, I guess you would call him, in his late 60s, someone who, again, has always been associated with the diplomatic side of things, involved with the Oslo process, and someone else with almost no discernible popularity among Palestinians. For these two to continue to have any kind of authority, their legitimacy would unquestionably have to be enhanced by elections throughout the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. The other two are Ruhi Fattouh, who is the Speaker of the Palestinian Legislative Council and who's been named as the interim president for a 60-day period. I don't think that he will necessarily stay in that job, presuming that there are elections to that position. And the last is the new head of the Fatah Central Committee, Farouk al-Qaddoumi, or Abu Lutuf, who's been the head of the PLO political department for a very long time and who is one of the founding members of Fatah.
Now, of course, a prime minister was the one job that Arafat did not hold in that constellation.
Mm-hmm.
But as you say, to get legitimacy, to get credibility, elections, do you expect internal fights of some sort?
Well, my guess is that Fatah will run a single slate. The question is who will be on that slate and who will be at the head of it. My guess is also that there's going to be a very tough decision for Hamas whether to run in these elections, in which case they might not win. In fact, they probably won't win, but will thereby be lending legitimacy to a whole process, the Oslo process, which they've always rejected,
mm-hmm.
or to stay out of them and see their opponents confirmed in power and see their legitimacy increased. So that's one of the interesting things that might happen in an electoral process. The other thing will be just to see whether, in fact, it is possible to have an election. And I think the Palestinians are ready. In fact, registration has been underway for several weeks because there were municipal elections. There are municipal elections scheduled for December. And bills for legislative and presidential elections were sitting on President Arafat's desk when he passed away. So the Palestinians are actually ready for it. The question is, will the conditions, which means lifting the siege on most Palestinian communities imposed by the Israeli army for the better part of 2 years, will those conditions will be possible to create them?
And there's a lot of, obviously, that will go into that decision, including whether Hamas participates, and thus perhaps the level of violence might be reduced as well. So,
all of this would certainly depend, moreover, on a ceasefire, including
yes.
Hamas.
Yes.
So, I mean, that's almost a precondition. And that brings us back to one of the sore subjects for those who know some of the details of the last 4 years. There have been a series of informal ceasefires, and they've broken down not only because of Hamas or other Palestinian factions. They've often broken down because of Israeli refusal to be bound by a ceasefire and Israel taking advantage of those ceasefires to assassinate people. There would have to be an ironclad ceasefire applying to everybody, not just all the Palestinian factions, but also Israel, if this whole process is to move forward. And that's going to be difficult to achieve.
Let's get a caller on the line. James is with us from Baton Rouge.
Yes.
James, you're on the air. Go ahead.
All right. I'm curious to know if Arafat's refusal to name successor is an expression of Arafat's own arrogance and ego, or if he really hoped for a political process to take place after his death, something that never occurred while he was alive. And I was wondering what your experts think about that.
Rashid Khalidi?
Well, it's hard to say what he intended. He's dead now. I think that the fact that there was a procedure, at least in terms of the Palestinian Authority, which was laid down and which has now been followed, indicates that this whole idea of you refuse to name a successor is a little bit exaggerated. It's been much repeated in the press. In fact, most of the people who were his colleagues and equals, his co-founders of Fatah, were assassinated over the years, the people who were really the natural successors. I have to say, the people who have now stepped in are by some measure second-rank figures. They're not people of the importance of Abu Jihad, Abu Iyad, or George Habesh, who is not dead but who's incapacitated. He's very ill. These are people who really were important figures in the Palestinian movement, and there are no equals to them among this group that has now stepped into the void. So Arafat was very jealous of his power. There's no question, and that was one of the worst problems of the Palestinian political system in the last 10 or 15 years. But it was exacerbated by the fact that there was nobody who could really stand up to him. The ones who could had all been killed or passed from the scene.
The one name we do hear is that of Marwan Barghouti, who, of course, is now serving several consecutive life sentences in an Israeli prison.
That's correct. But Marwan Barghouti is a very popular person. He's the only person who really scores in public opinion polls pretty much of anybody alive at this moment. Arafat is now dead. Sheikh Ahmed Yassin has been assassinated by Israel. Barghouti has a following. He has a following among prisoners in Israeli jails. He has a following among Fatah. He has a following in many parts of the occupied territories. The problem, of course, is that A, that he's in jail, and B, that he is of a much younger generation than these men who've taken over in the interim period. And it's going to be interesting to see how the relationship between that older generation and the generation represented by and, I think, led by Barghouti is going to develop.
James, thank you.
Thank you.
Let's get another caller in. This is Al. Al is calling from Eugene, Oregon.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
My question is, if Arafat didn't come to the scene, what would the Palestinian fate would have been? And also, what was he really offered during the last Camp David? Because the media here is biased. They always saying he was offered this and that, but we hear like Barack himself was disputing what he was offered.
Yeah, two good questions. I can't imagine. It's hard to speculate what would have happened had Arafat not arrived on the scene. Certainly, when Arafat and his colleagues resuscitated the Palestinian National Movement in the 1950s and 60s, the situation of the Palestinians was perilous indeed. They had just lost their homes. Most of them had lost their homes and livelihoods in Palestine. They were refugees. They were a people without representation. Certainly, he and the people who founded Fatah and later took over the PLO changed that in a striking fashion. As far as your second question, Barack, I just heard him on the BBC before I started this interview. Barack himself said, we offered a little more than 90% of the West Bank. I think the point is that Barack intended to keep a very large part of the West Bank, to keep Jerusalem under Israeli sovereignty. There would have been Palestinian control unspecified in certain parts of it. And he said, and that's it. It's a take-it-or-leave-it offer, and you must agree that that's the end of the conflict. That's it. You take this. And it was the kind of arrogance that Barak, those who know him, those who know about his political career, would find characteristic. President Clinton understood that that wasn't sufficient, though he blamed Arafat thereafter for not accepting it. And President Clinton repeatedly improved that offer at the end of his term in December, and then there were continuing negotiations on that in Taba. I think the key thing is that for the Palestinians, the idea that having made the historic compromise, having accepted that their ancestral homeland is going to be divided 78% into Israel and 22% into Palestine, the West Bank, the Gaza Strip, East Jerusalem, to have the Israelis then take slice after slice of that is something that most Palestinians wouldn't have accepted. Arafat's rejection of the Camp David offer, not so much of what President Clinton later offered, but the Camp David offer, was very popular among Palestinians. They would not have accepted the kind of restrictions on their independence which Barak was demanding, things like Israeli control of the borders and so forth.
Al, thanks very much for the phone call.
You, for taking my...
We're talking about the life and legacy of Yasser Arafat and where things go from now. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And in regard to what you were just saying, Rashid Khalidi, there was a comment by one of Arafat's aides, Jibril Rajoub, to Al Jazeera earlier today. He was the only one who understood the importance of national unity. There will never be a Palestinian leader willing to bear the consequences of saying no to the Americans and Israel. And I think what a lot of people, Americans and Israelis perhaps, are wondering, will there ever be a Palestinian leader willing to say yes?
Well, it depends on what they're offered. If they're offered what Barak offered, I don't think any Palestinian leader could take a yes back to his people and get them to approve it. I mean, Palestinians feel that they're people and that they have a right to sovereignty. That means not Israeli control of their airspace, not Israeli control of their borders, not Israeli control of the water beneath their feet, not Israeli control of their movements. Those were the things inherent in Barak's proposal.
But let's get beyond Barak's proposal and get back to the idea of where are the Palestinians and how are the Palestinians going to find a leader with comparable clout, someone who, if they accepted a deal, whatever it may be, could come back and get it through.
Well, I don't think there is anybody who's going to have the there will never be anybody with the historical legitimacy or the ability to tower over Palestinian politics like Arafat. But you know, democratic processes are remarkable things. There are various ways of getting legitimacy. One of them is to achieve things for your people. And that requires smart negotiation, hopefully smarter than Arafat was capable of doing. That requires knowing when to say yes and knowing when to say no. And that also requires help from others. Abu Mazen was systematically sabotaged by Israel when he was prime minister. During that period, he asked for prisoners to be released. Instead, Prime Minister Sharon released prisoners to Hezbollah, a group which is dedicated in its opposition to Israel, and refused to release prisoners to Abu Mazen. He systematically cut the ground from underneath him. If that is what happens to the Abu Mazens and Abu al-Alas of this world, it's no wonder they have no credibility and very little legitimacy. If, on the other hand, they're able to achieve things for their people, that in turn will increase their legitimacy and the support for them, and it'll enable them in the future to make tough decisions. I think also being elected will be enormously important.
And if there are elections, when would they be held?
Well, it's hard to say. I mean, it requires a great deal happening between now and elections. The ceasefire that we've talked about is absolutely essential. The organization of them is not that hard, but to have elections, you need campaigning. To have campaigning, you need to move. Municipals can be held in December without anybody moving because each little village, each little town cut off as it is can do that. But to have national-level parliamentary and presidential elections, Palestinians have to be able to do something they have not been able to do for the last several years, which is to move around. People don't realize it. We talk airily about the Palestinians and the Israelis. We don't realize that the Palestinians are locked up in their towns and villages and have been for years.
Rashid Khalidi, thank you very much for being with us today.
A pleasure.
Rashid Khalidi joined us by phone from his office at Columbia University in New York City, where he holds the Edward Said Chair of Arab Studies. We'll be back after a short break to talk about the U.S. role in the post-Arafat Middle East. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Now we're going to talk about how this may change American foreign policy in the Middle East. With us here in Studio 3A is Robert Malley, director of the International Crisis Group's Middle East Program and served as Special Assistant for Arab-Israeli Affairs under President Clinton. Good to have you back on Talk of the Nation.
Good to be here.
And let me ask you begin by asking you whether the death of Mr. Arafat, who, of course, President Bush and, of course, Prime Minister Sharon as well, had said was not a partner for negotiations in the Middle East. Does this offer a window, an opportunity?
Well, I think the word opportunity probably would be deemed offensive by a number of Palestinians. I think it's probably better to avoid it. The United States and Israel had decreed that Arafat was an obstacle to peace. They said it. They weren't prepared to deal with him. So whether or not objectively he was an obstacle, the fact that he's no longer in power puts the United States and Israel to the test. Are they now prepared to do what they said they weren't prepared to do in the past so long as he was there? And I think the burden will be on President Bush to show that, in fact, he's determined to move towards a two-state solution that he repeatedly talks about.
And so you would see the ball at this point in the American court?
Well, it's in all three parties' court, but it is, among others, in the American court. There's a lot that they didn't do, we didn't do, over the past 4 years as we saw the situation go from bad to worse. And our own strategic position in the region go from bad to worse. Now's the time to really try to act and to try to move things forward between us and the Palestinians and between Israel and the Palestinians.
David Makovsky joins us now. He's director of the Project on the Middle East Peace Process at the Washington Institute and the former executive director of the Jerusalem Post. Good to speak with you again.
Good to be with you.
And let me ask you, we have Tony Blair, the Prime Minister of Britain, arriving here in Washington today. He is reportedly set to urge President Bush to invigorate the Middle East peace process. Is this a moment to seize on that?
Yes, I do. I think that it's hopeful, especially if Mahmoud Abbas, Abu Mazen, and some of his colleagues seem to be the transitional collective leadership that's going to take form. I think that this is a moment. I think we should avoid what I would call an all-or-nothing approach, which is to pretend that what happened the last 4 years, the trust was shattered, the partnership just dissipated, that we're not going to be able to solve this century-old conflict tomorrow morning. But that should not be an excuse why we shouldn't do what we can do. And I think there's a window here of that we're all sides. I was in Ramallah this week. I was also in Jerusalem and Tel Aviv. And I sensed on all sides that people believe that now is a time to do what's possible. On the Palestinian side, that could mean elections, it could mean a ceasefire, it could mean a dialogue started with Israel and with the United States. And I think on the Israeli side, it is going to mean if Gaza withdrawal is going to happen, it shouldn't be unilateral, but it should be coordinated. You just don't take the keys and throw them over the fence. We had a chance for Ramallah Spring in the summer of 2003 when Abu Mazen was prime minister. Some would argue it didn't matter because Arafat would have cut the legs out from under him. But I think that opportunity was missed. Maybe no one on all any side, whether it was in Ramallah, Jerusalem, or Washington, did enough to strengthen the cause of Palestinian reform. Maybe we're going to get a kind of a second chance now. And I just sense that there's more hope now than we've had in years.
Robert Malley, on a practical level, does the process have to await a Palestinian leadership that has gathered some legitimacy, some authority in its own areas?
I think it depends very much what you mean by process. There's some things that could happen right away. I think the most helpful thing for the new Palestinian leadership would be if things change on the ground for Palestinians, if they had greater freedom of movement, if the state of siege were loosened, if settlement construction were slowed down or halted. All those things, you don't need to have a process for that. These are benefits, these are changes in the Palestinian lives that they could experience on a day-to-day basis. And if that happens, then indeed the Palestinian leadership would be strengthened, and we could then get to the point where a reinvigorated process could actually be commenced.
Mm-hmm. Let's get a caller on the line. Christopher joins us from Louisville, Kentucky.
Hello, Neil. This is Christopher. Actually, I am a Sephardic Jew. Lived in Tel Aviv a long time, but I have a question for you, guests. Actually, I don't think Israel, even though I am a Sephardic Jew, I don't think Israel has in mind there more land grabs, the demolition of more refugee camps. I'm a human rights activist. Also, a question to your guest. Isn't Hamas created by Mossad, the Israeli Secret Service?
Okay, Christopher, thank you very much. Some questions about history, but certainly at this point, whatever the origins of Hamas, it certainly represents a challenge to whoever emerges, David Makovsky, as the leader of the PLO or the Palestinian Authority.
That's correct. I mean, Hamas poses a challenge both to the Palestinian Authority and to Israel. You know, when I was just in Ramallah, the people who met with Hamas this Saturday in Gaza were upbeat that at least in the short term, that they realized the public wanted to get behind a new leadership. They were tired of the attacks, and they didn't want to go down that route. But the question is, you know, how long will Hamas hold its guns, and will it try to trigger a series of attacks in an effort to try to provoke an Israeli retaliation at a very delicate time? I mean, the Hamas enmity towards Israel has been a constant, and we should remember that. The question might be, though, that if a ceasefire could be arranged that, you know, is in keeping with Israel's security requirements and gives this new Palestinian leadership a chance, maybe that's something, you know, that shouldn't be sneezed at. So I'm more hopeful in the short term about Hamas, but I'm very deeply skeptical. I mean, they are a classic rejectionist force. They don't accept Israel under any boundaries, 1967 or otherwise. They want to wipe Israel off the map. So maybe in the short term, you could try to reach accommodations, because in fact Abu Mazen's not going to be strong enough to confront them. But as his power grows, then I think down the road, you know, you're going to have to think creatively of how to deal with this issue. I agree with Rob Malley, with, you know, on your previous round, that you got to look for some confidence-building measures here on all sides that would help strengthen the Palestinian leadership at this time. I don't know of the exact details, but I think the idea could be useful.
Yeah. Well, Rob Malley, we thought we saw the way ahead, for good or ill, that Israel would continue to build its security barrier through parts of the West Bank, including that there might be a withdrawal from Gaza. It certainly looked headed that way. How does that dynamic change now?
It's a very interesting question. I suspect that the withdrawal from Gaza is now far enough in the Israeli political psyche that it's not going to be interrupted. I think, as David was suggesting, its means and modes of implementation may be amended so that it's done in a way that actually is viewed positively by Palestinians, as opposed to the way most of them look at it now. That doesn't necessarily entail negotiations. In fact, I think negotiations wouldn't produce much, but it does mean coordination. It does mean doing it in a way that is a full withdrawal, because it's unclear now whether Israel will withdraw from all of the crossing points. It has to be done in a way that empowers Palestinians and makes them feel that for the first time they're actually sovereign on any piece of land.
Mm-hmm. And David Makovsky, is it vital to get conversations going again?
Absolutely. I think the contact should be going in many different directions. U.S., Palestinian, Israeli, Palestinian, U.S. I mean, I remember having a conversation with Abu Mazen in Ramallah 6 months ago, and he said, I mean, this has been consistent with him. He said, look, the main thing is security. If we can, you know, assure the Israelis on security, I think they will be forthcoming towards us. So, I mean, a lot of the, you know, suspicions, I think they were very clear in the Arafat era. This has been the context to everything we've known about this issue is under Arafat's leadership. But a new approach, and Abu Mazen has said, with the militarization of the Intifada, has been a mistake, not just because it's counterproductive to Palestinian aspirations, but because it's morally wrong. Again, these are the sorts of things we're not used to hearing. So I think if we're in a totally new environment, a lot of things that seemed impossible might seem possible, but you gotta crawl before you can walk, and you gotta begin somewhere. But like I said, I'm more hopeful now than I've been in a long time.
And Robert Malley, let me end by asking you, how is it you think at this juncture the United States, the administration, can help?
I think it could help by trying to produce changes on the ground for both sides. If we're focused now on the Palestinians, because they're the ones who are going through the transition, it does mean producing real changes on the ground. We could sit here and be enthusiastic and be optimistic. I don't think right now it's a time of enthusiasm or optimism among Palestinians. They've lost the only leader they've known. For most of this is a terrible period of mourning. I don't think one could expect from them great changes in their approach to Israel. They are now focused on themselves. If they see changes on the ground, I think that could promote a change in their way of thinking. But again, whatever positive attitude we're sensing in Israel and the United States right now, for Palestinians, it's a period of profound grief.
Let me give you the last word, David Makovsky. Would Palestinians fear a weakened leadership?
Sure. And that might mean that a lot of the rivalries that have existed, that exist, you know, between the West Bank and Gaza, between an older generation and a newer generation, between those in Tunisia and abroad and the refugees, and some of those that are more local in the territories, a lot of those rivalries could be muted because they fear the fragility of life without Arafat. But in fact, I think that that might mean that they might be able to come together in a way that they have not in the past, because Arafat often played them off against each other. We should be very frank about that. Mm-hmm. So I agree with Rob that this is a time of grief. You know, Arafat put their cause on the map, and you cannot take that away from him. But at the same time, this transition could be a glue that will bring a lot of these disparate factions together, even if it's for a short time. But I think that it's vital if there's going to be any hope, you know, for the future of progress.
David Makovsky, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you.
David Makovsky of the Project on Middle East Peace Process at the Washington Institute joined us by phone from his office, and Rob Malley was with us here in Studio 3A. Thank you.
Thank you.
Rob Malley served as Special Assistant for Arab-Israeli Affairs to President Clinton, now Director of the International Crisis Group's Middle East Program. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News.